Alright, today's is Teaching Tuesday, and we're going to go over literary terms that you will see brought up in your day-to-day English class that you may need whenever it comes to reading any sort of literature, particularly short stories and or novels. I'm going to be splitting them up by alphabetical order, so try and hold on, and as we go through the long list of things that you guys need to know. All right, this first segment deals with the A's that are important for us today. So the first one is going to be an allegory. This is a type of figure of speech where there's these abstract ideas and principles that are described in terms of characters, figures, and events that we can understand a little bit better. This allegory tries to teach a moral lesson. The most familiar one analogy that most people know of is Pilgrim's Progress. This is a story, allegory, whatever you want to call it, that deals with the Christian life. So the beginning of the book starts with the main character becoming a Christian, believing in God, and then the whole book until the end is that Christian walk, what it takes to walk as a Christian, and all the pitfalls and things that Christians deal with, and what they need to put their hope and trust in, what they shouldn't, and then ending up in the end of the book getting to heaven. So that's the most well-known allegory that I can think of right now. The next thing that I want to talk about is what the definition of an antagonist is. So an antagonist can be anything. It can be a person, it could be a thing, it could be an emotion, whatever it is. It's the thing that is always in contrast or is fighting against the main character. So it could be the villain, like Jafar, whatever. It could be a thing, like an emotion, could even be the main character's thoughts and emotions that they're having to deal with, and they're in conflict with it. So an antagonist is just whatever the main character is in conflict with, whether that be a person or a thing. The next item on my list is a term that you'll mainly see in poetry, but I wanted to include as well. It's called assonance. And the first three letters of this word are spelled A-S-S, but that's not what the meaning of this word is. This word, assonance, is when you have two or more words that are close to each other that repeat the same vowel sound, but they both start with different consonants. So it's kind of like a rhyming technique, which is why I said you'll mainly see it with poetry, because it deals with rhyming. But that still doesn't mean that it can't be used in other literary works as well. The fourth thing is an alliteration. This is another type of that rhyming idea. It's when you have a number of words, usually close together or in a series, meaning in the same sentence, they'll be right next to each other, that have the same first consonant sound. So alliteration and assonance, usually you will see more primarily in poetry, sometimes in Shakespeare's plays you'll see them, but that doesn't mean that you still can't use them in other works or see them in other works. Alright, the next thing, an analogy. This is a comparison in which an idea or a thing is compared to another thing that's quite different from it. I know that sounds kind of weird, but let me finish. The purpose of an analogy is to explain an idea, thing, that you don't really know, to something that is familiar. So, examples of this that would be a little bit easier for you to understand maybe would be metaphors and similes, which we will get to later. But an analogy is just a more extensive and elaborate tool than a simile or a metaphor. And as I said, we'll get into those later if you don't know what those are. All right, an archetype is the next thing on my list. This is a typical character, a typical action or situation that seems to represent the universal patterns of human nature. This could also be called a universal symbol. So, as I said, it could be a character, theme, a symbol, setting, action, situation, whatever. There's lots of opinions that archetypes shape the structure and function of literary work, because archetypes have that a common and recurring representation in a popular human culture or human race. The next thing on my list would be an aside. This is something you will primarily see in lots of plays, especially the plays written by Shakespeare. An aside is when the playwright has characters, dialogues, uses characters and what they say to tell their own stories. But it often becomes difficult for them to express what their characters are thinking. So, they came up with a typical dramatic device, as I said, called an aside, to help solve this problem. This is just a short comment or a short speech that the character delivers directly to the audience, or to himself, whichever it may be, while the other actors on the stage appear not to hear what's going on. Only the audience knows that the character said something to them, or something, the character said something to the character themselves. As I said, Shakespeare does this quite often. Hamlet did this quite frequently. Lots of asides. And if you still are a little confused about that, shoot me a message or ask your own English teacher to show you some examples of what an aside would look like, because I'm fairly confident that they would have those examples ready to go for you. Alright, the next thing I want to talk about is an allusion. Now, I said allusion, not illusion. Allusion with an A, not an I. Because I've had a lot of kids have trouble with this. So an allusion is a belief or an indirect reference to a person, place, thing, or idea of historical, cultural, literary, or political significance. So it does not describe in detail the person or thing in which it's referring to. It's just one of those passing comments, and the writer expects the reader to be able to have enough knowledge to understand what they're hinting at. So an allusion is kind of like a hint towards another instance, or kind of like an inside joke is what an allusion is. So for a lot of people in America, or people who grew up in the 50s and 60s, you know, the Wizard of Oz. If I said, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore, I'm hinting to the fact that, you know, this isn't the situation that we would typically see in Kansas. This is something, or at home, this is something completely new, different, XYZ, fill in the blanks, you know. So a lot of people would know, oh, that's from Wizard of Oz. They know the whole background of the story, so on and so forth. It makes sense to them. So that's kind of like an inside joke, an inside secret, if you want to say, is what an allusion is. Alright, second to last thing about the A's. So it's called an anecdote. This is a short, interesting story or an amusing event that's often proposed to support or demonstrate a point the author's trying to make, sometimes to make the audience laugh. This can include an extensive range of tales, stories, XYZ, fill in the blanks. So it's a short description or an account of any event that makes the readers laugh or brood over a topic that's presented for the purpose of the paper, the story, whatever. An anecdote is usually used in speeches and in academic papers in your introduction and or conclusion to help get that information to the reader, like, hey, think about this. Use the information I've given you within the body of the paper and or speech to make this story I told you ring true, make you actually think about it, or think about the whole topic in general. All right, the last thing about the A's for our literary terms is called an argument. Now, if you've been in any high school language arts class, sometimes even in middle school, you know that there are lots of things that you have to argue about whenever it comes to papers. And if you listen to my Types of Papers Thinking Tuesday episode a few weeks ago, you'll know that an argumentative paper what that is. If you can't remember, go back and listen to it. But an argument is the main statement of any written document, whether that be a poem, an essay, short story, novel, whatever. It usually appears in the introduction part, or a point on which the writer will develop their works, used to develop their work in order to convince their readers. Now, literature does not merely entertain, because today we're talking about literary definitions. So, everything that's literature, so whether it be a short story, a poem, an essay, a poem, novel, whatever, it's not just to entertain you and give you something to keep your mind off of your everyday life. It's intended to shape the outlook of readers or how you view the world. So an argument does not just serve only as an introduction. It attracts the reader's focus to an issue that's going to be made clear gradually throughout the story. Alright, so we've just finished the A section. We're going to move on to the B section. And FYI, the B section is going to be short, sweet, to the point. It's only one item on this list, so the segment's going to be very, very short. And it is called a bias. Now, just because this is the only thing that I'm going to talk about today does not mean that talk about in this segment. It only means that it's that important, that it gets its own segment, it gets its own individual attention, because it is that important when it comes to your writing and or things that you're reading to be able to identify what the bias is. Now, if you don't know what a bias is, I'm going to give you the definition, but hopefully by now you know what it means. So a bias is undue favor, undue support, or backing extended to a person, group, or race. It can even be an argument against something else. Now, although biases are mostly exist in the cultural context, it can creep into other things, especially in academic life, such as literature, and in literature, such as, you know, your views on sexuality, on gender, nationality, religion, certain subjects that aren't on this list, and then just life in general. So usually an easier way to describe it, is that it's a one-sided, illogical, and non-neutral support of a viewpoint that, you know, doesn't really look at the other side. There are, of course, as I said, various types of biases that you can hold that you might not even be aware that you have. So it could be in the form of propaganda, any sort of gender or age related items, racial discrimination, religious discrimination, marginalization, stereotyping. All that is bias. And when it comes to reading books, short stories, poems, whatever, and even writing those essays and poems in your classes, you need to be aware that putting biases, especially ones that are considered to be over the top biases, try and keep those out of your work, because yes, they will creep in, but you need to make sure that they aren't in there in a way that's going to be harmful to you and to anyone else who's reading your work. Alright, this segment is going to be dedicated to the literary terms that begin with the letter C. Now, there's going to be lots of subcategories in some of these things I'm going to talk about. So just stay with me, keep going. If you need to take notes to help, that's fine. So let's get started. Alright, so the first one is catastrophe. Now, you might already have preconceived notions about this, so let's just see if the definition I have matches yours. So, catastrophe is the final resolution that usually appears at the end of a narrative, plot, or long poem, unravels the mystery or intrigue, and brings the story towards a logical end. In a tragedy, it could be the death of the protagonist or another character. Usually in a comedy, it would be the union of major characters. So catastrophe, in this sense, is a synonym for the denouement, which I will get to when in the next segment when we talk about the D's. I think I have that in my notes, but in fact, it's the final, just called the final part of the story. All right, so this next one is one of those words that have lots of subheadings. So if you need to pull out a pen and paper, or pull up your computer to help you remember all these things, this would be the time to do it. So, character. This is, could be a person, a figure, an inanimate object, an animal, whatever. A character, there's, it's just the what we call the things in the story that are doing the action, that you see the development, XYZ, so on and so forth. So, you know, Toy Story, the toys would be the inanimate objects. You know, Andy would be the people, the dog, the little dachshund would be the animal, certain figures that you would see, so on and so forth. Now, there's different types of characters, as I said, so we'll keep going. All right, so the first type of character is a confidant. So this is someone the main character confides in. They, you know, because there's that confidant with, that's like buddy-buddy with the main character, you're able to see into the main character's thoughts, their intentions, some of the personality traits. The confidant doesn't have to necessarily be a person. Could be an animal, like in a lot of the Disney princess movies, they always have those little animals that are with them, and they talk to them. Those are the people that they, the people slash things they can confide in when the other people or things in their lives don't make sense, or they can't go to those people and things. The next type of character is a dynamic character. This is a character that changes during the course of the story, whether it be a short story, novel, play, so on and so forth. This change in that character is permanent and changes their whole outlook on life. So this is why dynamic character could also be called a developing character. So dynamic, developing, both are synonymous. They work because they're both developing and changing. Okay, third type of character is a static character. This is kind of the polar opposite of a dynamic, developing character. This is a static character, stays the same throughout the whole entire story. Throughout everything they go through, all the events that they have that dealt to them in the story doesn't change their outlook on life, doesn't change their perceptions, their habits, their personality, their motivations. Just someone who just will not learn or change because they just can't see what's right in front of them. All right, the next type of person we've already talked about in the section A, it's the antagonist. It's the person, thing that is against the main character, which is the next type of character we're going to talk about, the protagonist. So a protagonist is the technical, official, literary name for the main character, the hero. This is the person, the character who all the action of the plot is created around, and they're the ones that usually engage the readers or the listeners or the watchers, whatever, rousing their empathy, interest. You know, you fall in love with the main character or whatnot. As I said, it could also be called the hero or the heroine of the story. So, person that the whole plot moves around. Without the protagonist, you really wouldn't have a story. Okay, the next two deal with the shape of the story. So we have a round character and a flat character. So a round character is one of those well-developed, complex characters in the story. They're more realistic, they demonstrate more depth in their personality, can make surprising or puzzling decisions, attracting the reader's attention, but there are also many factors that could affect them, and so round characters react to such factors realistically. Whereas flat characters are the polar opposite. They don't change at all during the story. They usually only have one or two personality traits at best. These are those characters that just were not well developed, that you're like, how did they even stay in the story? Should have just been cut and tossed out. You know, going in back to the kind of a static character, static, flat. They're both kind of the same type of character in a way. They both really don't change. They're kind of barely developed, well thought out, that sort of thing. Okay, so the last type of character I want to talk about is a stock character. This is, again, a type of flat character, but these are instantly recognizable by readers. So like a flat character, the stock character does not undergo any development throughout the story, but people are usually able to say, oh, that's, you know, the funny guy of the story, because usually there's that funny sidekick who is always completely hilarious, is the, you know, comedic, the one who's the comedic relief. You know, they're not really well developed, but they do provide lots of humor for everyone. So that is all the types of characters. Now, the next big section that has subsections is the very next C on my list. So characterization, not to be confused with character, but characterization. So this is why I said you would need a pencil, paper, Word document, something to write this down, because it gets dicey. All right, characterization is a step-by-step in literature ordeal where you highlight and explain details about a certain character in a story. So, in its initial stage, the writer introduces the character with noticeable emergence. So, after the character is introduced, the writer often talks about his behavior, then as the story progresses, the thoughts, processes of the character is developed. So, characterization is just how the character is built. Now, there are two ways that this can be done. There's the direct characterization and the indirect characterization. So, direct is you take that direct approach to it, building the characters. You know, it uses another character, narrator, or the protagonist itself to tell the reader or audiences about the subject, whether it be the person themselves, the situation, what the letter says, the people's reactions, their tone of voice, so on and so forth. Indirect characterization is the more subtle way of introducing characters or ideas, situations to the audience. So the audience has to deduce from themselves that the characteristics of a character through their thought process, their behavior, the speech, their way of talking, their appearance, the manner in which they communicate with the other characters, as well as discerning the response of other characters. So an example of a direct characterization would be, you know, saying, the character saying, I hate you, and they storm in a loud voice, I hate you, or this is terrible. Another way of direct characterization could be, you know, they were mad. You know, you're just directly saying what it is. Indirect could be telling, you know, would you know a person hates someone by how they look, how they're acting, the tone of voice in which they talk to a person. They're not explicitly saying, I hate you, but they're doing a roundabout, indirect way to let everyone know, hey, I don't like this person. This person creeps me out. I don't want to be around them. Or, you know, they stomped out. You know, their footsteps could be heard, force flights down, the door slammed, and the air in the room was thick and heavy with the fact that that person was upset. Those are my, you know, rough, trying to quickly get through everything examples, but again, if you need more clarification, please let me know, or go talk to an English teacher at your school for more help. Alright, the next few are going to be pretty easy on my list, so if you don't need to write down everything, you don't have to, but the next few are going to be pretty easy. So, cliches, the next one on my list. This is an expression that's been used to, you know, overdone, overused, to where it loses its original meaning, or the novelty, whatever. It just could refer to actions and events that are predictable because of some previous events. So, you know, well, how cliche, you know. So, oh, look, so-and-so is mad again at their ex. They aren't ever mad at their ex. That's so cliche, you know. It's always like them to do that. Why are we not surprised anymore? That sort of thing. All right, the cliffhanger is the next type. Pretty easy to understand. This is just a device that where the end of the story is ended abruptly, sometimes curiously so. And the fact that main characters are left in a difficult situation. Usually there's no way to resolve the conflicts given. It just suddenly ends. So as a result, there can be some sort of suspense created. I know there are a lot of TV shows where they end an episode on a cliffhanger. You're like, oh, what's going to happen? How's this going to get resolved? And you have to come back for the next episode in order to figure out what's going on. Same thing could be used at the end of a chapter. So you're like, oh. I didn't expect the chapter to end like that. I need to read on to figure out how it was solved and why it was like that. So on and so forth. That's just usually lots of novels that were published serially, which means each chapter was published in a novel or magazine, you know, one at a time. So if it was a monthly magazine, you'd have one chapter a month. And so you'd have to wait till the next month in order to get the next chapter. If it's a, you know, weekly newspaper that you're publishing in, you'd have to wait every week in order to get the next chapter, so on and so forth. So that's a lot of things that a cliffhanger would be used in. Just giving you some examples, trying to help put the name to the thing that's being used. Alright, the next C on my list is a climax. Again, if you've had any sort of intensive background in an English classroom, you know the term climax. This is just the point in the story which the conflict or the tension in the story is at the highest point. This is, you know, the big crisis, the big moment that, like, oh no, I don't know if they're going to, you know, make it. This is the decisive moment or the turning point in the storyline where the rising action turns around and becomes the falling action. So once this crisis or conflict reaches its peak, it calls for that conclusion, the denouement, resolution, everything. Alright, next on my list is a colloquialism. This is the use of informal words, phrases, or even slang in a piece of writing. So these expressions tend to sneak in as writers, being part of any given society, are influenced by the way that the people in that society speak. So let's say that in the South, many people call soda or soda pop a Coke. So they say, hey, I'm going to go get a Coke. You want me to go get you one? They're meaning, I'm going to go get some soda, I'm going to go get some pop, whatever it is that you call it. And you'd have to, so if you actually want a brand flavor or flavor Coke, you would have to tell them, hey, could you go grab me a Coke? So make sure that you know where the situation, the story's coming from, where the author's coming from, so that way you know, okay, this is how they talk, this is what they mean by this. Same thing goes with countries, because what we in America call cookies are not the same thing called the same thing over in England. So just make sure you know what the colloquialism is for the area and that you're familiar with it or you brush up on it. Okay, the next thing is called a conceit. This is just a figure of speech in which two vastly different objects are linked together with the help of similes and metaphors. So again, another one of those analogy type things. The next thing on my list is a conflict. If you don't know what it is, this is just a struggle between two opposing forces. Usually, most commonly, it's between the protagonist and the antagonist. So, just that continual butting of heads. Next is a connotation. This is where a meaning is implied by a word apart from the thing that it's actually describing. So this is kind of like the hidden meaning, the reading between the lines type thing of your words. So it could be that you and your boyfriend or you and your girlfriend have, or you know, if you're married, husband, wife, when you're a child, you and your best friend, you have the phrase, words that don't actually mean what it is, but no one else but the two of you know it. So that would be a connotation. All right, the next word is consonants. This kind of goes back, not this one. So consonants is a repeated sound produced by consonants within a sentence or a phrase. So it often takes place in quick succession, like pitter-patter. So that's kind of a consonant. Pitter, the T's, usually, so pitter-patter, that's what a consonant is. All right, context is the next one on my list. This is, of course, the background, the environment, the setting, framework, surroundings, events, or the occurrences within your story. So, context means circumstances forming a background of an event, an idea, or a statement in such a way that it enables the readers to understand the narrative or literary piece, whatever it is you're reading. It's always necessary in writing to provide this information, new concepts, and words to help develop those thoughts. All right, the last two are going to be quick and easy, hopefully. So the second to last is contrast. This is where, of course, writers identify differences between two subjects, places, people, things, ideas. It's just the opposition between two things highlighted to emphasize their differences. A critique is the last thing we're going to talk about in this segment. So, critique is, you're evaluating a piece of work, whether it be literary, political, or philosophical theory, in detail. You're just using your magnifying glass, going at it, looking at everything as finely as you can, looking for maybe those errors, hidden meanings, etc., etc.